the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Next year, California cops will have new rules to consider when deciding on using deadly force. But will changing the standard from when reasonable to only when necessary save lives? Plus, how posh local beach resorts are waging war on pesky pigeons and seagulls by getting hawkish with the help of falcons. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for starting your week with us. Coming up, we're going to talk to a falconer about using the famed birds of prey to control so-called nuisance animals such as seagulls and pigeons. More on that in about 15 minutes. And we'll also look into new research out of UCLA that says students who try to learn in classrooms without air conditioning are more likely to fall behind than students who do. Those details in about 20 minutes. But we start today in Sacramento. California now has some of the strictest rules for when police officers can use deadly force. Now, the new law comes by way of a bill signed this afternoon by Governor Gavin Newsom. The measure comes months after negotiations with law enforcement groups. Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler was at the signing. Hello, Ben.
Hey.
Now, the bill we're talking about is AB 392. What changes for law enforcement are in now that it's signed into law?
Well, this all boils down to two words, necessary and reasonable, and how you define them. So right now, deadly force is justified in California if a reasonable officer would have acted similarly in that situation. In other words, that's what a typical officer would do based on his or her training. When the law takes effect in January, that standard will change to when the officer reasonably believes deadly force is necessary, the key word being necessary, although the measure leaves interpretation of how to define it up to the legal system to figure out by a case-by-case basis. There are a couple other parts of this deal worth noting. The officer's conduct leading up to the shooting will be considered, as will the suspect's behavior, and there is language in the bill that allows police to use other alternatives, de-escalation, less lethal options, before using deadly force, but these requirements are a statement of intent, not a specific checklist.
And this legislation, born out of the shooting death of Stephon Clark, he was shot by Sacramento police last year. Did that incident kind of provide the bill with added fuel as it worked its way through the legislature?
Absolutely. Although there were, you know, it did take some time for this all to get through. So the bill was introduced after last spring's shooting of Clark. And it gained momentum, but nobody really seemed able to reach consensus or any sort of compromise. And so late last year, just before the legislature adjourned, Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins sidelined the bill. And she said, look, you know, this isn't ready. And I want both sides to sit down while the legislature is in recess and work through into a deal. Then early this year, the talks broke down and the different bills moved. There were a couple of different bills, one backed by law enforcement and this measure, and they both worked through the legislative process. And as they were going through the process, in March of this year, in separate investigations, Sacramento County District Attorney's Office and California Attorney General Javier Becerra each announced they would not be charging the police officers who shot Clark. And that really did, I think, help spur changes, spur this bill across the finish line. And yet, you know, neither side really got everything they wanted in it, even with the Clark shooting and the decision not to prosecute.
Now, while this bill was being debated, the law enforcement organization said the bill's language endangers officers, that regulations maybe could cause them to second guess themselves in the field. Ben, did law enforcement groups eventually come around, and how are they feeling today after its signing?
So they moved from opposed to neutral on this bill because of some of the compromise terms I laid out. They are also backing a separate bill, which I think we're going to get into a little bit later, but it deals with training for officers. And there's money in the state budget also for that training. And so all of that combined moved them to neutral. And I think the point was that both sides realized they did not have the votes on their own to get what they wanted without reaching some sort of consensus. So last week, I spoke with California Police Chief Association President Ronald Lawrence, who's the chief of police for the Sacramento suburb of Citrus Heights. And he says the most important thing moving forward is for officers and the communities they police to build trust.
How do we, you know, put aside the emotion, put aside all of the discussions at the Capitol, how can we get to a point where we start to build that trust again?
There is still that trust to be built.
Yeah. Now, okay, so meanwhile, activist groups, some of them had lobbied for the bill, ended up dropping their support, saying that too many changes were made to satisfy law enforcement. What are you hearing from civil rights activists today?
There is a bit of a split, and so let's hear from a couple. And I should say this split isn't all that surprising, considering that as I said, everyone had to compromise to reach a deal. So I've got two cuts queued up here. The first is from Stefan Clark's brother, Stevante, and he says, slow progress is better than no progress.
I call this the Stefan Clark Law. You know, I don't think this law would be here and as powerful as it is now if it wasn't for my brother.
But Sacramento community activist Barry Axia says even though he fought hard to get this bill signed, he is not as optimistic as others are about how it will be executed.
Is it really going to be an action bill, a bill that makes sense, a bill that will actually hold these officers accountable?
And until, Axia says, officers are held to the same standards as everyone else, in his mind, this will still be an open question.
And looking ahead a bit, Ben, there's another bill backed by law enforcement that might have been seen as a companion bill to the law that was passed today. That one is SB 230. It would order the state's police training commission to develop new use of force guidelines. That bill passed the Senate, now is in the Assembly. What would that bill change, and where does that one stand now?
So to say where it stands right now, it is hung up in the Assembly. It didn't need to be. My understanding is that everyone was willing to move it forward, except perhaps the chairwoman of the Assembly Appropriations Committee, Lorena Gonzalez, who I believe wants the bill to go through the full process along with everything else. And it will. Governor Newsom reiterated today he expects that bill to reach him and he expects to sign it. And that was kind of a little, I don't know if it was sending a message or not, but it was making clear that to everyone that this is part of the deal and it is going to get through. As for what it will change, you know, there's some disagreement about that. Backers of the law signed today, the legal standard law, say, you know, this bill isn't important. We're not concerned with it. We are focused on the legal standard. Law enforcement groups argue, look, we have these new legal standards. We need to train officers in them. And now there's money behind that training in the state budget. And if you raise the standard and you train, then that standard of how would a reasonable officer act? Would a reasonable officer perceive that deadly force is necessary? Well, if the reasonable standard is raised higher for officers, law enforcement argues that would also help go a long way to reduce the use of deadly force, and potentially, if an officer acts out, inappropriately, would make it more viable for them to be charged.
You mentioned, Ben, that AB 392 will go into effect January 1st of 2020, and I guess on all sides, everyone's hoping that any of this will save lives, will prevent lives from being lost. What is the hope that you've heard that this will do that, that it'll accomplish what it sets out to do?
It is a hope, but it is also a trust and verify, especially from everyone. From even Gavin Newsom acknowledged it as he signed the law, saying, you know, look, we'll miss this moment if we just call this a victory all by itself. Certainly heard that from the bill's author, Dr. Weber, the assembly member from San Diego. And you heard it from activists, including Barry Axias, who we just heard from. And on the law enforcement side, I think they know that they need to build trust. And I think... Look, I mean, nobody is hoping there's going to be more deaths, and everyone's hoping that this will do something. So we'll see.
Ben Adler is Capitol Bureau Chief for Capitol Public Radio. Ben, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Few reporters covered Asian communities quite like Connie Kong. In fact, Kong made history doing it, believed to be one of the first Asian immigrants to work for a mainstream newspaper in the United States. The Korean-American journalist passed away last week. She was 76. Fluent in Japanese and Korean, Kong was most recently employed with the LA Times, where she mentored a generation of reporters. One of them, Hyung Wong Kong, who collaborated with Connie for three decades. He now works for Reuters. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, you and Connie worked together at the Times when you were the front page photo editor. Tell me, how did you two first meet?
I met Connie back in the mid-80s when I was still at UCLA working at the Daily Bruin. I went to one of the summer camps for leadership conference, and she was one of the guest speakers. I didn't know about female Asian journalists working in the mainstream until I met her. And we stayed in touch, and then we ran into each other again when we covered the South Korean student protests of the 1987.
So that was a big deal for you to meet her then.
Oh, yes, because, you know, as a Asian American student studying at UCLA, we really did not have role models to look up to, and she was one of the few I ran into when I went to a leadership conference.
Now, she eventually wound up becoming a mentor for you, but within a few years, you had a role in changing the course of her career. Tell us about that.
Well, by the time 1992 LA riots came along, I was the only fluent Korean speaker in the newsroom at the LA Times. And while I could do both, taking pictures and reporting, I couldn't do both well because I just don't have enough time in the day. So after the riots were quieted down a bit, the Asian American Journalists Association met with the editor-in-chief and demanded that we put more reporters who can speak the language of the communities that we cover. And that's how they created positions for a Korean-speaking journalist to come to LA Times. And we reached out to her, but she was hesitant to come to LA for a couple of reasons. One was she thought the LA air was not as clean as the Bay Area. And number two, she didn't drive. She didn't have to drive in San Francisco. So she had to, at her age, learn to drive once she came to LA, and that was a huge effort on her part to learn to drive in Southern California.
She was right to be worried for both reasons.
Yes, but by the time she got here, LA riots was over, of course, and we were focusing on aftermath and we were focusing on Asian American communities, and she just couldn't get enough of people calling her wanting to tell their stories because before her, there were nobody on the LA Times Metro desk who can take calls from non-English speaker from the Korean community, for example.
Now, you two collaborated on several projects. Can you share one that was particularly special to you?
For me, that was in Korea, actually. She wanted to document the founding ancestry of her last name, Kang, which happens to be mine as well. So we traveled at least 3 days to the countryside and met with the clansmen of the Kang family headquarters and had them explain to us how the founding grandfather is shrined at that location. You know, she's an anthropologist when it comes to reporting, just very thorough, very careful, and so at ease with people to open up and tell us stories that they wouldn't talk about in general.
Well, that's a big deal. I mean, to find out about your own last name with someone who shares your last name.
Exactly. I mean, it happens to be that Kang is like fifth most popular last name in Korea. And even though we're not related family-wise, if we go way back several hundred years, I'm sure we're related.
Talking to Hyung-Yung Kang, senior photo editor with Reuters, and we're remembering journalist K. Connie Kang and her notable work with Asian communities in L.A. We know that faith played a large part in Connie's life and work. How did her personal beliefs reflect the very complex identity of Asian American communities that she covered?
Her family is of a Christian family from Pyongyang, North Korea, and they fled during the Japanese colonial period and during the Korean War out of Korea. So her family has sacrificed a lot for being Christian. Her mother's last wish was for her to carry on the original intent of eventually building a school in Pyongyang for Christians and to teach future Christians in North Korea. Connie and I talked about going after retirement from my journalism job to work on this full-time to eventually put a Christian school in Pyongyang, North Korea. It is unfortunate that she couldn't complete that task with me, but I might have to do that by myself.
Yeah, well, you never know. You both started it together in a way, so why not continue the legacy? Now, I'm wondering, when we're talking about legacy, what kind of legacy does she leave behind for the community she covered and the journalists that she may have inspired?
I think Connie lived in a complex paradox growing up and living in Asia and in the United States, working as a career journalist, trying to compete with the mainstream and have to carry the burden of the Asian family's cultural expectations of being filial to your parents and take care of them, as well as being competitive in the mainstream in the English language, which is the second language for all of us. And her wordsmithing was just very disciplined, and she spent a lot of time writing her books and her stories. And she works exhaustively in her craft, and that kind of work ethic, I think, put her in front of other colleagues when it comes to quality of writing that she produces. And I'm sure many Asian American female journalism students looked up to examples like Connie to become one like Connie one day.
Hyungwon Kang, senior photo editor with Reuters, remembering journalist K. Connie Kang and her notable work with Asian communities of Los Angeles. Thank you very much for sharing your memories of her.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
All right, imagine yourself poolside at a posh beachfront resort, relaxing, soaking in some sun. You order an overpriced burger, but who cares? You're on vacation. When it finally comes out and it's placed beside you, the next thing you see is a seagull dive bombing right for it. You try to shoo it away, but it's too late. Your burger went to the birds. Coming up, how local hotels are getting hawkish with the gulls by fighting fire with Falcon. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Have you ever been to the beach enjoying some fries, maybe a hot dog, then all of a sudden, swoop, that seagull flies in, steals your grub? Yeah, it's a problem. Along with pigeons and blackbirds, seagulls are considered nuisances at beach resorts, airports, farms, and other office buildings. And that's why, instead of opting for spikes, nets, or fake owls, commercial buildings are calling on the natural predator of these birds, the falcon. Master falconer Adam Chavez is owner of Adam's Falconry Service, which provides flying pest abatement for commercial businesses. Adam, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. Flying pest abatement, what does that entail?
Well, I got into it at the age of 12, basically, as a falconer, and I just turned into a business about the past 6 or 7 years. And what we do is we use birds of prey to scare away. They're basically hazing, nuisance birds, and it can be in a lot of different environments. It could be, like you said, landfills, retail centers, agriculture, HOAs, beaches, golf courses, airports, where you're preventing bird strikes, any of the above. And so that's what we do on a daily basis.
Now, hazing, though, when you're hazing other birds, what does that mean?
It means basically we use our birds of prey to establish a predatory presence and chase out, the birds that we're trying to push out. It's usually either going to be seagulls, crows, a lot of pigeons in the L.A. area. It just depends on the situation. They're all different.
Okay, so say I got a hotel on the coast and I got a seagull problem. I call you, Adam. Do you have to come out and evaluate my property first, or can the falcons get started right away?
Well, it's always best to come and see the situation first, because some places you can use large falcons, some places hawks. It depends on how tight the situation is, or if there's a lot of land or a small amount. You got to use different birds based on the scenario. So it's going to be what the bird, your pest bird, is. If it's a small bird, then a big large falcon's really not going to do the job. You need a small falcon to push out a smaller bird, and that's kind of how it works. So for starlings, you use things like Oplomato falcons. It's a little Peruvian falcon. When you talking about pigeons, you can use – a lot of the hotels are basically using like a Harris hawk, because a Harris hawk more or less can fly from point A to point B and chase the birds out. And those Harris hawks are extremely smart. They live in family units. And so I can actually – it took me 3 days to train one of those birds with a laser pointer to go wherever I point that laser. So let's say you have a pigeon that flies up into the eave.
Yeah.
I can point the laser up there, and the hawk will fly up there and chase it out.
So it's totally tailored then to your exact location.
It is. Yep.
Wow. We're talking to Master Falconer Adam Chavez, owner of Adam's Falconry Service. Okay, so the ultimate objective, is it just to scare the gulls or the pigeons or the starlings away for a short time, or is it maybe to get it in their brains, into their bird brains, to stay away from my property for good?
It's to stay away from the property for good. The key is to figure out, the frequency you need to go to make that happen. So, if they've been – a lot of times when I get the call, they've tried everything else. They've tried the spikes. They've tried all that stuff. And all that stuff works for a small amount of time. Then, of course, the birds adjust, right? They're going to figure it out. So what they don't figure out is, you know, the predator, the predatory presence that's been established for, you know, millions of years. It's ingrained in their in the bird's brain, and they know if a bird of prey is hunting, it makes more sense to leave the area. And if you're there all the time, then, you know, they start to get the message and they move on.
But is a pigeon smart enough to remember that, hey, that place has a hawk or has a falcon there? We better not head there. Let's head somewhere else.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Matter of fact, crows are really smart. So we have certain areas down in Orange County where there's HOAs, they have crow issues. And the crows, after going several times, they get so smart that they will recognize my truck. They will recognize me. They will recognize my bird. I have one guy that said that he was literally 3 miles away from the site going to eat, and the crows recognized him and were following him. So they know, and they also know the perimeter. They know where they can be and where they cannot be. I'm not saying that, you know, when you turn your back, they might not try and sneak in, but they do know.
How often, Adam, do your falcons have to, you know, kind of break some beaks, kind of set an example?
It's different in every situation. But what we try and do is a lot of times we want to establish that predatory presence right up front. So we might go 5 to 7 days, you know, 6 to 8 hours, and then start backing off based on our assessments and seeing how often we need to go. But we try and get it down to 3 days. You know, some places we're only going 4 hours a day, three days a week. And then summer seasonal, you know, where you've got certain birds that come in at certain times of year, you push them out and then you're good, and you may not be back for 6 months. And you know, in certain areas it might be, if it's pigeons, you have to kind of trap and remove them from the site, so because they will home back. But most of these other birds, if you put a presence in, you know, if you're there long enough, you're going to push them out.
But if the falcons have to get rough, I mean, do they do that away from where customers are so that customers can't see it, or does it just happen wherever it happens?
Well, the good thing is I've been doing this a long time, so I can set up the situation to get the results I want. So in other words, I'm going to let that pest bird know we're coming, and we're going to let him see him. He's going to know that we're there. I'm not trying to – it's not like I'm trying to hunt and sneak up on him. There's a difference. You know, if he sees it coming, he should be able to get it out of the way. Now, do they always? No, I'm not going to say that they've never caught stuff. I mean, they do on occasion. You just take it away and, you know, cut it loose later because we're right on the scene with the birds. But that is rare, you know, unless we're trying to hunt, which we're not. Now, there are certain places you actually get depredation permits in place if it's really, really bad, and they have to, you know, catch a few birds to make sure they get the message.
I guess, Adam, what I'm asking is it like the Godfather, you know, the horse head on the bed? Do you leave, like, a pigeon head on some pool side or something just to, you know, let all the other pigeons know, hey, no, you better not head there?
All they need to do is see our bird. So what you can do is you can let the bird catch a lure and eat off the lure in front of them, which you're getting that same message across. You know, it sees a bird of prey eating something, and obviously they don't like that.
That's Adam Chavez, master falconer and owner of Adam's Falconry Service, which provides flying pest abatement. Adam, thanks a lot.
You bet. Take care.
Moving on, when it's hot outside, most people enjoy air conditioning. But for many, it's still a luxury, even in schools where many classrooms do not have AC, even though classes are back in session at one of the hottest times of the year. As students head back to school, we wanted to find out more about the connection between air conditioning in classrooms and how it affects student performance. Jisung Park has looked into this for the UCLA Luskin Center for Innovation. Professor Park, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Now, looking at the weather forecast this week, temperatures are expected to be hot, and school is back in session for a lot of kids in Southern California. What does the research tell us about trying to learn in a classroom that is hot?
What we find in our study is that essentially hotter temperatures, even hot temperatures in the vicinity of 80, 85, 90 degrees, can actually reduce the rate of learning, right? So it's not just a little nuisance you can shrug off and power through, but that over time, the cumulative influence of having more hotter days during the school year, especially for students who who go to schools that don't have modernized facilities, right, they actually seem to be learning less over time. At least in this context, we measure in terms of standardized performance on standardized exams.
I can imagine, Professor, that just being in a hot place, you get annoyed, you don't focus, but you tell me, what's the science behind it?
Yeah, so we've actually known for a pretty long time, at least based on shorter-term laboratory experiments, that if the temperature gets pretty hot, your cognitive ability, your ability to focus, your attention span, all of those things seem to decline. There are these studies that go back to pre-World War II studies of British naval officers. They put them in a room, jacked up the temperature, asked them to perform a series of tasks, and lo and behold, their sort of productivity or their accuracy on these tasks fell if the temperature was hotter. What we haven't known is whether in real-world settings, over time, right, over many months and years, whether that kind of effect, whether it's on attention or cognition or just fatigue, can actually accumulate or add up into differences in the amount of learning, and that this effect is much larger for racial minorities and lower-income students who tend to go to schools without air conditioning and without effective cooling systems.
Talking to Ji-Sung Park with UCLA's Luskin Center for Innovation, talking about the connection between hot classrooms and reducing learning outcomes. Now, your research found that the extreme heat contributes to the racial education achievement gap, and that could even further reduce future earning potential for low-income and minority students. Explain that link for us.
Let's do one step at a time. So, you know, we're using data from roughly 10 million students of all racial and economic backgrounds across the United States. And what we find is that, say, a day above 90 degrees during the school year has a much larger negative effect on the amount of learning that is achieved by racial minorities, African-American, Hispanic students in particular, than, say, for whites and Asians. So the disparity angle is that we've known for a very long time, right, there's a very large what's called a racial achievement gap in terms of standardized performance. And what we haven't known is to what extent the physical learning environment in which this learning occurs actually contributes to this. And our data suggests that a non-trivial proportion of the black, white, or Hispanic, white achievement gap in standardized performance can be attributable simply to the combined influence of living in a hotter place and not having as much access to cooling infrastructure.
Is there a number, a percentage, Professor, on that? On the gap, the achievement gap between, say, students that are in schools with good infrastructure, with air conditioning, and ones that aren't?
Yeah, the gap between, say, African-American and white students on average in the United States is around a standard deviation. And we find that the combined impact of African-American students and Hispanic students not having as much school air conditioning and living in hotter places contributes around 7% of that gap. And we know that that can have effects on the economic opportunities that these students can have access to. We appeal to other studies done by other economists who link gains in standardized achievements or test scores to future earnings potential or future earnings based on tax records.
Now, when it comes to climate change, I would imagine that that could make this issue a lot worse. Doesn't, though, the use of air conditioning contribute to global warming?
Yeah. No, that's a great question. There's sort of a catch-22 with advocating for more air conditioning as an adaptation to climate change. But I'd flip that around a little bit and ask, you know, if the energy that was used to power the air conditioning was clean, i.e. it didn't involve fossil fuels, that wouldn't be a problem, right? And so I think the onus is on us to, A, do what we can to decarbonize the electricity grid, and in California has been a leader in that space, but B, in the meantime, we need to protect the most disadvantaged communities from the effects of climate change that are already coming down the pike.
Now, at some point, LAUSD has said that it's going to install air conditioning into all of its schools. How does air conditioning help reduce that learning and achievement gap on a basic level?
So if you think about, on the one hand, there's one set of students, let's just say within LA, right? Mm-hmm. One set of students go to school learning the same material in modernized facilities. So when a heat wave rolls in, maybe it's a little bit annoying in the morning when they're getting to the classroom, but otherwise, not a big deal. And then there's another classroom or another school where the facilities haven't been upgraded in 30 years. Air conditioning is present, but it's broken. And so for them, that whole week, it's just tough to even learn anything. And so that gap in their knowledge sort of accumulates over time into reduced sort of learning or standardized achievement. But hopefully there is a day, you know, in the near future where even if our children aren't able to have the same educational resources on every dimension, at least in terms of the physical environment, we can have some parity.
Jisung Park is with UCLA's Luskin Center for Innovation, speaking with us about the connection between hot classrooms and reduced learning outcomes. Dr. Park, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Women being forced into sex work is about as serious of a topic as it gets. We've heard stories of Korean women during World War II being made to work as comfort women for Japanese soldiers. Stories that are difficult to hear but important to tell. Coming up, a new way to tell those tragic tales by making them into musicals. That's next when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. World War II ended nearly 75 years ago, but the memory of what happened to tens of thousands of Korean women during the war is still raw for many. They were forced to work at brothels serving the Japanese military and became known as comfort women. In California, members of the large Korean-American community have tried to honor the women with monuments and lobbied to have them mentioned in textbooks. KPCC's Josie Huang says there's another effort, putting on a musical about them.
At a theater in downtown L.A., it's rehearsal time for Comfort Women, the musical that's running this month. A troupe of young women dance across the stage.
I wave bye-bye, try to hold my breath.
The song offers some light in a musical about a very heavy subject. As many as 200,000 women and girls, mostly from Korea, were forced to work at so-called comfort stations across Asia. The women in the musical think they're signing up for factory jobs, only to learn too late from a Japanese soldier that they've been duped.
Your bodies now belong to the Great Imperial Army. You are to allow our soldiers to enjoy their time with you.
This is a controversial issue. The UN says Japan employed a widespread system of sexual slavery, and the Japanese government has apologized to the comfort women. At the same time, the government has fought efforts around the world to memorialize them. In South Korea, the surviving comfort women are treated with honor and care. But in the immediate decades after the war, people often saw the topic as taboo.
We are shameful about letting that kind of thing happen to us. We're so weak, and why talk about it?
Steve Chung is the producer of Comfort Women that first opened several years ago off-Broadway. He grew up in South Korea and moved to the U.S. as a teen. He noticed how different it was here, how people placed value on remembering their histories, however dark.
Say Holocaust or genocide in Armenia.
Chung went on to become a Korean food distributor, but his passion is theater. Last year, he caught a production of Comfort Women in New York and decided he had to bring it to L.A. He felt a musical was the perfect medium to attract non-Koreans and teach younger Korean-Americans about their ancestral past.
Our next generation getting too Americanized, which is good. My kids are like that, too. But you got to leave something and tell them history correctly.
Chung has poured $50,000 of his own money into staging the musical, which runs through the 25th at the Los Angeles Theater Center. He can be spotted at rehearsals alongside director Demo Kim. Kim, who's 28, has been obsessed with musicals since he was 4 and saw a production of Cats in Seoul, where he grew up.
And after that, I was like, I'm going to make a musical.
But he didn't think his first musical would be about comfort women until he came to the U.S. to study theater. He was startled that few Americans knew the history.
Classmates, friends, professors don't know about the issue at all. I mean, not even the term itself.
Kim started to develop the musical, inspired by real-life accounts of comfort women. But the subject matter made it hard to find the right tone.
You cannot go too high or too fun because of topic issues. But because of topic issues, you cannot also go too low because then it's boring, then nobody's going to watch it.
In trying to strike that balance, the show features the tragic comic figures of two orphan sisters, happy-go-lucky young women who are tricked into working at a frontline brothel.
I'm the cutest.
Actress Jennifer Sun Bell portrays the older sibling, Namsoon. Before she saw the audition notice, she had no idea who comfort women were.
I'm actually half Korean, and I was so angry and so just ashamed that I didn't know this is part of my heritage.
Belle relates to the women on another level. She is a sexual assault survivor.
And it's taken me so long to accept that happened. And I'm just so like inspired by these grandmas and how they are able to speak out now and have so much strength and courage to do so.
When Belle takes to the stage in one of her character's pivotal scenes, emotion is written all over her face. She sings about being a shooting star. And her character pleads, tell the world who we are. Covering Asian American communities, I'm Josie Huang.
Now, this musical about comfort women is not the only way local Korean American activists are trying to bring attention to the issue. Joining us now with more is reporter Josie Huang. Hello, Josie.
Hi, A.
All right, before we get to the specific efforts to commemorate comfort women here in LA, let's get to just how advocates are able to make the comfort women issue relevant today, because what happened to them took place in Asia nearly 75 years ago.
Yep, that's true. This took place a really long time ago. But the activists I'm hearing from say it's important to remember the past so you don't repeat the mistakes of the past. And they've compared their work on comfort women to how Armenian Americans in LA, right, they march every year to commemorate the Armenian genocide, which took place more than a century ago. Another point that activists make to me is that their cause is not just a Korean one, but a human rights issue. And this is something I heard from one of the main leaders of the Comfort Women movement in California. Her name's Phyllis Kim, and she founded this group, Comfort Women Action for Redress and Education, which is based in Glendale. And she points out that the systematic rape during war that we saw with the Comfort Women is still very prevalent today. You see it with Boko Haram as well as the Islamic State. So this is how she puts it.
The sexual violence against women during wartime is a universal human rights issue that needs to be addressed. The perpetrators need to be held accountable. So I think it's really important for us as the global leader to raise awareness about it so that it doesn't happen again anywhere in the world.
And A, I should mention something that I noticed is that some of the most active advocates are 1.5 generation, meaning that they were born in Korea but came over to the U.S. when they were relatively young, and they feel like they have a duty to keep comfort women in everybody's thoughts, not just non-Koreans, but also the younger Korean-Americans who don't know about this history.
And as you mentioned, very controversial subject. We know how Koreans feel about the comfort women issue. What about the Japanese? What are they saying?
Right. So to this day, tensions over comfort women and also Japan's occupation of Korea are very high between the two countries. And the Japanese government has made a number of moves over the last few decades to try to calm the controversy. You know, in 2015, the Japanese government gave about $9 million to a fund that was created to help comfort women. And in the past, Japanese government officials have apologized for what the military did to the women. And I got a statement for my story from the Japanese consul of LA saying, quote, the government of Japan has extended its sincere apologies and remorse to all those women known as comfort women who suffered immeasurable pain and incurable physical and psychological wounds. Now, at the same time, the Japanese government is fighting the installation of comfort women memorials and statues in and outside of Asia, so in the U.S. as well. So you have Korean activists who feel that Japan, based on its actions, despite its words, owes comfort women a better apology than the one that they've gotten in the past.
Now, speaking of memorials, isn't there one here in Southern California?
Yeah, it's there's one in Glendale that was installed in 2013. It's of this girl sitting in a chair by herself. And there was quite a bit of controversy at the time where you had a group of Japanese nationalists suing to get it removed. But the courts defended Glendale's right to put up the statue. More recently, though, the statue has been getting attention because last month, a groundskeeper found that it had been smeared with a brown substance. Okay, I spoke with Glendale police who said it appears to be some kind of feces. And this alarmed activists, of course. This has been the third such incident in recent months. But police don't have any suspects to even question about whether this was a hate crime. So what they're doing now is just training a surveillance camera on the statue to make sure it doesn't happen again.
That is really awful. How else have activists in California tried to bring attention to comfort women?
Well, it's been mostly on the school front. Back in 2016, activists successfully lobbied to get comfort women mentioned in history textbooks that are used by California high schools. It's only a few sentences, but the Korean American activists who got this to happen treated as a major victory, especially considering that there were some Japanese groups who had fought this being mentioned. Also, activists have developed a 40-page resource guide on comfort women that they're distributing to whichever California school teachers want to use them. And I've also heard of high school groups getting involved. Like there's one in La Crescenta whose members have raised money for the Comfort Women and made videos raising awareness about what happened to them.
That's KPCC's Josie Huang. She covers Asian American communities for KPCC. Josie, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
If you're driving through the intersection of Woodman Avenue and Addison Street, you'll notice a rainbow reflected on the road. And there's a reason for that. It has nothing to do with the weather. It's a memorial for hit-and-run crash victim Connor Lynch, who was just 16 when he was killed. But he will not be forgotten under new Los Angeles Department of Transportation initiative to honor the victims of those who have died in traffic crashes on LA's roadways. On Friday, LADOT honored Connor Lynch with the installation of its first Rainbow Halo Memorial. It's a multicolored disc that hangs above a traffic signal light or signpost at or near the site of a fatal traffic collision. When sunlight shines through the disc, it casts a rainbow-colored shadow on the ground. LADOT plans to install a total of 100 Rainbow Halo memorials as a way of raising awareness about traffic safety. The city is working with transportation planners, police officers, and policymakers to eliminate traffic fatalities by 2025 as part of its Vision Zero program. Every 36 hours, a person is killed in a traffic crash in Los Angeles. That's more than 200 people a year. A couple of things most Angelenos know about the Magic Castle in Hollywood. It's a super special club for magicians, and you can't just walk up to it and expect to get in. Extremely difficult to access. Coming up, we'll hear how someone did get in and what she heard. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. At the top of a winding driveway on the edge of Hollywood Heights sits a huge Victorian mansion, home of the familiar yet exclusive Magic Castle. Since 1963, it's been kind of a clubhouse for magicians, illusionists, and celebrities, but KQED's Jessica Plotchek said the magic words to give us a peek inside.
You get in by saying the secret password to an owl on a bookshelf. Open sesame? And with that, the bookcase swings open. Inside, the mansion's burgundy walls are covered in ephemera and dimly lit by chandeliers. The place is maze-like, and it's easy to feel lost and a little overstimulated by all the ornate details. It kind of feels like a magician's version of The Great Gatsby. Winding your way up staircases, down halls, through bars, lounges, and banquet halls, sometimes you won't know what floor you're even on. There are four theaters. The biggest can seat 150. The smallest, about two dozen.
Change it to a beautiful, shining, silver half dollar.
And that's not to mention impromptu performances you'll see from magician bartenders. And the amateurs who will make your card appear tattooed onto another guest's wrist.
No!
Then there's various magic installations. The Magic Castle's Vicky Greenleaf brought me over to Irma, a piano-playing ghost you can ask questions and interact with.
Irma, how are you tonight? I've heard it said that the biggest trick in town is getting into the Magic Castle, so you do have to know a member or a member magician to get a pass.
But these days, if you're staying at one of their partner hotels, you can get in. And once you're on the list, you gotta dress up, make dinner reservations, and do not take any pictures inside. Even if you see Adele, Ryan Gosling, or Neil Patrick Harris, who used to be the president of the Magic Castle board. This is LA after all. In the Owl Bar, I found one of the two brothers who started this place, Milt Larson.
You know, my father and mother were in magic, and we were the Larson family of magicians.
They toured California doing shows and opened a magic shop in L.A. His mother is said to have been the first woman magician on television. People here call the Larsons magic royalty.
There's a picture in our seance room where I'm 8 years old doing a coin trick for Mrs. Houdini.
Milt's also met a lot of magicians since opening the Magic Castle, and he is not afraid to share his opinions.
Have you met David Blaine?
I'm not terribly fond of him.
Milt took the lead on renovating this building when they first got it and fixed it up using salvaged materials.
They tore down the L.A. County Courthouse, and they took the judges' doors and used them as paneling in these theaters.
This top right here is from the gymnasium floor of Hollywood High.
There are artifacts from notable magicians and even old sets from television shows and movies.
Those backdrops are the original backdrops when the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson moved to Los Angeles. This was Jack Nicholson's headboard in The Witches of Eastwick.
While Milt was the builder, his brother Bill took care of the business. And for many years, Bill's wife Irene was considered the hostess. And she helped foster a place full of magic and pranks.
People taking the performers' clothes while they're changing, so then they had to run through the castle without their clothes. This is in the 70s and the 80s, by the way. I don't think anyone would do it now.
This is Bill and Irene's daughter, Erica Larson. Both of her parents have passed, but their legacy of enforcing the strict dress code is still around.
My mom's best friend was Siegfried from Siegfried and Roy, and one night he shows up in jeans, and he tries to get in, and... And basically, my mom was just like, Siegfried, you of all people cannot come in here in jeans.
Another rule, the library is members only.
People aren't expecting a library of 28,000 items in a club.
Librarian Joe Fox says magicians come here to practice in front of mirrors or fellow magicians. And unsurprisingly, even he has a few tricks up his sleeve.
Now, a letter opener is good for opening up the sinuses.
And with that, he shoved the 6-inch rod perpendicularly into his face.
Oh, this is really gross. Oh, God.
Does that look real?
Yeah, it looks really real.
Oh.
For the California Report, I'm Jessica Plachek in Los Angeles.
All right, one more thing before we go. There's an old saying, choose a job you love and you will never have to work a day in your life. Sounds dreamy, right? But how many people can honestly say that about what they do for a living? Well, here's a job opening that could make you one of those lucky ones. Farmer Boys is a California burger chain headquartered in Riverside. They are looking to hire, now brace yourself for this, a bacon intern. This person will spend the day eating bacon items from their menu, then judging them. Now, I know what you're thinking. I already eat lots of bacon for free, but here, at the end of your shift, you're not only going to have a belly full of bacon, you'll also be paid $1,000. Farmer Boys is now taking applications, but you got to hurry. The deadline is tomorrow, August 20th. And if you're interested, you can get a link on our website, take2.org. And don't ever say, Take Two ain't looking out for you. All right, if you missed any part of the show, you missed a really good one, just go to wherever you get your podcasts and look for the Take Two show. That's where we'll be. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.